Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway and this edition is published in the early hours of Friday, the 3rd of January. Our main stories: Turkey authorises the deployment of troops to support the UN-backed government in Libya, but President Trump warns against foreign interference. The Australian Prime Minister is heckled for his handling of the devastating wildfires.
How come we only had four trucks to defend our town? Because our town doesn't have a lot of money, but we have hearts of gold, Mr. Prime Minister.
And how artificial intelligence beat humans in diagnosing breast cancer. Also in the podcast:
people will post on their Instagram accounts. Intelligence is passed on to the poachers, who then utilise that to go and do some illegal hunting.
Are tourists unwittingly helping poachers in South Africa's biggest wildlife reserve? No one has been in full control of Libya since Colonel Gaddafi was overthrown in 2011. The UN-backed government has been struggling to maintain its hold on the capital, Tripoli, where for the past 9 months it's been under attack from the military strongman Khalifa Haftar. He is allied to a rival government in the east and is backed by Saudi Arabia, Egypt and the UAE, and reportedly even Russian mercenaries. Now, Turkey has voted to allow troops to be sent to Libya in support of the Tripoli government.
Değerli arkadaşlar, 3/1044 esas numaralı Cumhurbaşkanlığı.
The Turkish parliament backed the plan by 325 votes to 184. The decision was strongly condemned by Egypt, while Russia said it would only aggravate the conflict in Libya. And in a phone call to his Turkish counterpart, President Trump said foreign interference was complicating the situation in Libya. For more on what military aid Turkey might provide to the authorities in Tripoli, I spoke to Barbara Plataşa in Istanbul.
We actually don't have any details other than that this is a broad approval or broad authorization to send troops to Libya if necessary to fight terrorists, I think is how it's phrased. But there's no details about the size or the scope of any deployment or a date for it either. It's just a general approval.
Turkey is already supplying arms to the UN-backed government in Tripoli. Why is it involved in Libya?
Well, the Tripoli government in Libya is one of its only allies in the region, actually, and I think it wants to keep that relationship on board. It's also worried about its commercial interests there, its private investments, and its ships in the Mediterranean near Libya, because General Haftar has threatened some of that in recent months, and that was, in fact, mentioned in the bill. What President Erdogan has said is that Tripoli asked for help, for military support, and therefore he was responding, and has stressed the point that the government in Tripoli is the legitimate internationally recognized one, and has criticized other powers for supporting the renegade general Khalifa Haftar. Of course, many of those other powers are Turkey's Mideast rivals.
Yeah, Egypt, one of them, which backs Haftar. It has condemned this vote in Turkey, but it was also opposed inside Turkey itself by some opposition parties.
Yes, the major opposition parties did oppose the bill because they said that it would help to intensify the conflict in Libya. Apparently, the government had promised the opposition parties ahead of time, or had reassured them ahead of time, that this would not involve combat soldiers. But in fact, the bill does authorize combat soldiers, so it's not entirely clear what happened there. But it's not also clear that Turkey will be deploying that way right away. It's possible that it might start by sending military advisors and trainers. That at least is what some analysts think.
But Turkey's involvement in Libya, this increased involvement, is hardly going to smooth the situation there, is it?
Well, very few people think so. Again, what you hear from those who support it here in Turkey is that this is going to help Turkey's regional position, that it's going to prevent regional instability and will also strengthen its hand in other regional issues. But yes, it's a pretty crowded field. You have a number of Mideast countries supporting General Haftar, including Egypt and the United Arab Emirates. And you've got Turkey and Qatar supporting the government in Tripoli. And if more troops are put into that equation, it is going to become more complicated and perhaps more violent. Also, there have been reports that Turkey is considering sending militias allied to it. These are Syrian fighters that it has been working with in Syria who have a reputation for being Islamist extremists. So if that happens, that will further complicate the situation.
Barbara Platt Usher in Istanbul. Meanwhile, Greece, Israel and Cyprus have signed a deal to build an undersea pipeline to carry natural gas from the Mediterranean into Europe. The East Med pipeline will cost up to $7 billion and is expected to be completed by 2025. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it was an important step for his country.
This is a historic day for Israel because we're becoming an energy exporter for the first time in our history. But it's also, I believe, a historic day for our partnership and alliance in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Turkey has criticised the planned pipeline, saying it is unnecessary because of an existing one that runs through its territory. The wildfires in Australia have been burning since September, and there is no end in sight. At least 18 people have died, while another 17 are missing this week alone. Thousands of residents and holidaymakers are fleeing towns on the east coast, and the military has sent ships and helicopters to help rescue people who are trapped. Victoria and New South Wales have declared states of emergency. But many of those caught up in the fires have criticised the authorities. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, had to cut short a visit to one affected town after he was heckled by locals.
How come we only had four trucks to defend our town? Because our town doesn't have a lot of money, but we have hearts of gold, Mr. Prime Minister.
Nah, you're an idiot, mate. Oh. You really are.
You haven't getting any boats down here, buddy. You're an idiot.
Mr. Morrison has also been accused of not taking global warming seriously enough, but he defended his government's policy on climate change.
What we will do is ensure that our policies remain sensible, that they don't move towards either extreme, and stay focused on what Australians need for a vibrant and viable economy, as well as a vibrant and sustainable environment. Getting the balance right is what Australia, I think, has always been able to achieve. But right now, the focus, as I said at the outset, is to fight these fires and to get people to safety.
Latika Bourke is a reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald. So how is the climate change debate seen there?
Australia's well used to bushfires, but this extremity, this intensity, this degree, Australia has not seen before. And these are the worst in living memory. So while people run around in Australia saying, hey, this is not to do with climate change, Australia's always been this country of droughts, of fires and of floods. That's true. But the climate change scientists have always said that this is what would happen. Those things would become more intense. Those things would become more extreme. And now people are dealing with this inferno on their doorsteps. They're seeing their houses razed, their homes lost, and in many instances, lives gone. Scott Morrison has dealt with this extremely badly. He was overseas on holiday in Hawaii when these fires really did start to get quite intense, and there were lives lost at that point. He was forced to come back after a public backlash. I think he resented that, and now he has been in this scenario of saying, well, whatever has caused these fires, i.e. whether that's hazard reduction management, so backburning, that's a criticism of the Greens who oppose backburning. He's trying here to say to his supporters, this is not to do with climate change, because the moment he accepts that this is to do with climate change, he's in a very vulnerable position because his party is dominated by people who do not accept climate change is happening.
Latika Bourke. A few thousand kilometres northwest of Australia, meanwhile, heavy rain has caused flooding and landslides in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta. At least 26 people have died and tens of thousands have been evacuated. Jakarta is one of the fastest sinking cities in the world and often faces flooding during the rainy season, but residents say this rainfall is the heaviest in a generation.
This is the worst flooding I've ever experienced in my 22 years living here. It has never been like this before. This is the biggest flood I've ever seen since 2002. It looked like an ocean. The rain was very heavy. This is the new year. Imagine 2020 greeting you with a massive flood. But I want to continue to live here because when the floods hit, my neighbours and I are in it together, not alone.
Well, I've been speaking to our science editor, David Shookman, about this latest bout of extreme weather, and I began by asking him why the fires in Australia are so severe.
They're bad and scary for lots of people because they're happening on so many different fronts. So it's not like there's one fire that can be contained in one area. And unusually, the fires started relatively early in what is normally regarded as the fire season. So they've been running for longer. On top of that, they've entered areas which don't often see fires. So your classic Australian fire happens in what they call the bush, the scrublands, the grasslands. Most of these fires are actually in forests. And when you get a forest fire, as opposed to a bushfire, the flames are hotter, higher, and it's an awful lot harder to tackle for the fire crews.
And certainly in the past few weeks, we've seen a lot of hot weather in Australia. So is this linked to global warming?
Definitely it's the case that climate change has raised the temperature, the average temperature, by about a degree Celsius over the last century or so in Australia, as in the rest of the world. And that's clearly a factor, because once you've got hotter and particularly drier conditions, vegetation becomes more combustible. So scientists say that there's a very clear link, not to literally emissions from a factory thousands of miles away and this fire here in New South Wales, let's say. But in the general sense, the higher the level of emissions in the atmosphere, the more carbon dioxide there is to absorb the heat, the higher the temperatures, the more likely you are to see forest fires, bush fires, all kinds of wildfires, partly because of the raised temperatures, but also because the hotter the conditions, the more the soils, the plants dry out, they evaporate, release their moisture into the atmosphere. They are therefore in a better primed condition to burn.
And for Australia, as for other countries, it is a difficult issue because they are reliant on the coal industry for their economy, part of their economy.
They're very dependent on coal for generating 4/5 of their electricity, and it's a major export, particularly to China. So it's a huge earner. You see it manifested now with the difficulties the government faces. You've got a right-wing government in power in Australia, very supportive of the coal industry, very keen to expand it, very keen, and Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister, has said this himself, to support the jobs and livelihoods associated with that. But at the same time, Australia is very vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, as we're seeing now, and it's coming under increasing international pressure from environmental groups and other countries that are very keen to see action on climate change.
Now, we're also seeing those rains in Indonesia, a freak heat wave in Norway, and a lack of snow in Moscow. Is this part of a pattern, or is it just weather?
I mean, there have always been freak weather events in different parts of the world. See, you can't pin all of these on global warming. You can say that rising temperatures are likely to increase the frequency of certain odd events. So heat waves in the Arctic. I mean, they had extraordinary heat in Greenland, which I visited last year. I mean, people going around in T-shirts, wholly unexpected. Now, as I say, you can't pin it all on global warming, but you can say that things like that are set to become more frequent. Now, the case of the rainstorms in Indonesia, there is some science which suggests that warmer air can hold more moisture, which means that when it does rain, that rainfall will be likely to be more intense. So, again, you can say that the likelihood of extreme rain increases as the world gets hotter.
David Shookman, the BBC science editor. Next to the latest in our New Year series, looking ahead to the next 12 months. And it's the turn of our global health correspondent, Juliet Mazumdar.
Could 2020 be the year that the second worst Ebola outbreak on record finally ends? The Democratic Republic of Congo has been fighting the deadly outbreak since August 2018. But as we enter 2020, the world has more tools with which to fight Ebola than ever before. The first internationally approved vaccine will start being mass-produced in 2020, and further results from a major trial for a second vaccine are also expected. Now, this one was also a big one in 2019, but expect to hear lots more about the impact of climate change on people's health in the coming year too. The World Health Organization predicts that there'll be 250,000 additional deaths due to global warming every year from 2030, but it says it's a major health threat now. 9 out of 10 of us are breathing in polluted air every day, largely because of the burning of fossil fuels. And around 7 million people die every year because of the toxic air they breathe. That's around the same number of deaths from smoking.
Health experts and campaigners want climate change to be recognised much more in the context of a global health emergency, which is already unfolding. So scientists, doctors and patients are joining forces to ensure the health implications of climate change are pushed further up the agenda. Alongside climate change as a key global health concern in 2020 is the continuing rise in what's called antimicrobial resistance. As bacteria have adapted to the common antibiotics we all use, drug-resistant infections have spiked. An estimated 700,000 deaths occur globally each year due to these types of superbugs, and that number is predicted to grow to 10 million within a generation if no action is taken. The world desperately needs new antibiotics, but there haven't been any since the 1980s. In 2020, a key focus will be addressing the reasons behind that. Whilst there's been quite a bit of the initial research needed to make new antibiotics, no big pharmaceutical companies have taken on actually transforming that early science into the medicines. Drug companies are paid for the amount of antibiotics they sell, so there's not much incentive for them to develop new ones, which can cost billions of dollars. So countries such as the UK and the US are trying to change the way they finance these types of crucial new drugs. We'll see if these new initiatives start having an impact in 2020.
Our global health correspondent, Julep Mazumdar. And still to come in the podcast.
I hope this anthem inspires people to dream and to look up to Mars and beyond.
A song for the Red Planet written by an Indian opera singer. A new artificial intelligence system has proved as accurate as a radiologist at spotting breast cancer in scans, according to researchers. Unlike previous computer-aided detection systems, it learns to identify cancers based on the actual results of thousands of mammograms. Sarah Hyam, who's the director of early diagnostics at Cancer Research UK, explained why it's necessary.
There's a real shortage of radiologists in the NHS across the UK, at least one in 10 posts unfilled at the moment, and way more work to be done than they are currently able to do. So there is certainly a backlog, and if AI can fill a role there, that would be hopeful.
Okay, so a hopeful role that it could fill. What is your view of the outcome of this particular trial? Because it does, on the face of it, look pretty impressive.
It does look impressive research, yes. And we are very encouraged by the potential of the AI, as illustrated in this research, having accuracy that has actually surpassed that of an individual radiologist. So by small amounts, but the future is likely to look even brighter, because the more the AI system is trained on more test cases, so test mammographies, the better it should actually become over time. But we would need to test this now in clinical studies in the UK before making any decisions about rollout in the NHS.
But you are hopeful that this could be a significant tool for clinicians.
Yes, we are hopeful. And the researchers, the clinicians involved in this international study are very hopeful as well. I think it's probably surpassed our expectations in terms of the performance of the AI tool in reading breast mammograms and a potential usage within the NHS. So our breast screening program in the UK would be perhaps to take the place of the second expert radiologist in reading the scan. So in our breast program at the moment, women are invited between the ages of 50 and 70 every 3 years to be screened, and x-ray images are taken of both breasts twice and then read twice by two expert radiologists. The case here might be that the AI system could take over the place of the second radiologist.
Right. Are you concerned, because we're talking about Google Health here as well as established scientists at Imperial College, are you concerned about the access that might be available to patients data to make this actually effective?
We looked at and spoke to patient representatives before sharing any of the anonymized x-rays for this study. And so all of the data that has been used to train the AI system has been effectively anonymized, and so is therefore safe.
So it's safe at the moment under this particular trial, but there could come a point when it isn't safe. There's certainly potential for errors, aren't there?
I don't believe so, with the checks and balances that the NHS will always ensure are in place to protect patient confidentiality. Okay. It is an issue that we are very aware of and would make sure that patient confidentiality wasn't compromised.
Sara Hyam, Director of Early Diagnostics at Cancer Research UK, talking to Razia Iqbal. Over the past few days on the Global News podcast, we've been looking at the protest songs which inspired people in 2019. In our final offering, we go to Lebanon, where anti-government demonstrators have been demanding a complete overhaul of the political system. Their favourite chant, "The People Want the Regime Down," was written by Wael Koder and was first sung in 2011 during earlier street protests against corruption. Wael spoke to the BBC about it first, casting his mind back to the Arab Spring.
My name is Wael Koder, also known as my stage name Reis Beg. This song was created in February 2011. It was during the Arab Spring. So the revolution started in Tunisia and in Egypt. So we were kind of short on music and short on people. So we were a few people trying to shout. We didn't have any music that will bring people together, that will call for action, that will call people to come down from their home and come with us on the street. And I was also concerned about creating a music that will give energy to the people, energy to shout, energy to walk, energy to stand for hours and hours on the street. So it was, you on your balcony, come down and join us. You sitting in your living room, leave the TV and come join us. So it's a call for action, actually. It's a call for people to gather. And then I composed the music where I believe the main, let's say, character or the main instrument is a synthesizer that is playing an alarm sound, like a state of emergency, like this is now happening, you should move now. And then with this Thawra, with this revolution that happened, so the song was there and they were playing it more and more often and people were gathering. I'm happy it served the purpose. I mean, I feel proud, but also I feel that this song does not belong to me anymore. I created it for everyone to use it, and this is what's going on. So I'm very happy that it is serving a certain cause.
Wael Koder and the protesters on the streets of Lebanon in 2019. Tourists posting photos of endangered animals in South Africa's Kruger National Park are unwittingly helping poachers track down the creatures, according to officials in the park. They say a rise in selfies and boasting online is also leading to animals being killed on the roads in the reserve as visitors rush to reported sightings. The details from Richard Hamilton.
You will go on a walk at night through the bush that you will never forget.
An advert for the Kruger National Park by the South African Tourist Board.
You'll have supper under an acacia tree.
More than half of the 8,000 rhinos poached in South Africa between 2008 and 2018 were killed in Kruger and its adjacent private reserves. Elephant poaching in the park, which is roughly the size of Belgium, rose to a record high in 2018 with 71 elephants killed for their ivory. Ike Parser, who's a spokesman for Kruger, says posting images on social media is having terrible unforeseen consequences.
Our biggest problem is that people will post on their Instagram accounts. They will also post coordinates where those animals can be seen. Intelligence is passed on to the poachers, who then utilize that to go and do some illegal hunting. In some instances, it might be out of ignorance. They might not be aware that they are leading people to those animals. They might not be aware that poachers use intelligence and also are active on the social media platforms. If you generally say, I'm in the Kruger National Park and you don't have coordinates, it doesn't become much of a problem because the Kruger is a 2 million hectare property. So you could be anywhere in the world.
He says the other problem is people driving too fast to get to the animals. In recent weeks, three antelopes were killed by motorists, and in November, a giraffe died when it was hit by a speeding minibus and then catapulted into an oncoming car, leading to the death of a Swiss tourist. Kruger attracts more than 1.5 million visitors a year. A YouTube channel dedicated to the best sightings by tourists and rangers has more than 1 million subscribers, and a phone app providing real-time updates from the park with GPS coordinates has been downloaded tens of thousands of times. Officials are now considering a range of options, including jamming its phone signal to stop people advertising the locations of the endangered creatures. They stress that they don't want to discourage visitors from taking photos of their safari, but preferably, perhaps, with a traditional camera.
Richard Hamilton reporting. A woman and her two grown-up daughters have handed themselves in to police investigating a fire at a zoo in Germany that killed more than 30 animals. Officials in the northwestern city of Krefeld believed the fire was started by Chinese lanterns, which the women bought online, not knowing they were illegal. People have been leaving candles, flowers and soft toys outside the zoo, along with photos of the dead animals. Damien McGuinness in Berlin reports.
The three women wrote their wishes for 2020 on pieces of paper and placed them in the lanterns, which they then lit and sent floating off into the sky. It was supposed to bring luck for the new year, but things didn't work out like that. The lanterns landed on the roof of the tropical house in Krefeld Zoo, and within minutes, the building was engulfed in flames. Almost all the animals trapped inside died. Among them, a chimpanzee, Europe's oldest gorilla, and an orangutan with her offspring. The only animals to survive were two chimpanzees, who were found cowering in the ruins. The mother and her two daughters came straight to the police when they heard the news that the fire had possibly been caused by a Chinese lantern. Officials say the women have demonstrated courage and decency by coming forward and that they are in a state of shock and incredibly upset. But they could still face a prison sentence or a hefty fine.
Damien McGuinness. To end this podcast, a rising star in the opera world, who used to be a software analyst, has written a new anthem for Mars. Oscar Castellino from India was commissioned to give the Red Planet its own song by the UK's Mars Society to promote the idea that if humans ever live there, they'll need their own musical identity. But why not let him explain?
When people sing it and hear it, I want them to dream about this future that we have of our children and their children living across the solar system, and a great step that our generation can take, and we have an opportunity to do.
Rise to Mars, men and women. Dare to dream, dare to strive. Build a home for our children. Make this desert come alive.
I grew up in the mountains in India, in the foothills of the Himalayas. And we could see the stars very clearly out there. And that always inspired me, so that stuck with me. What's out there in the universe? Are there people? Are there civilizations?
Bring an end to strife, for our future lies beyond the skies. Rise to Mars!
So when we get onto Mars, it'll be a great achievement. And I expect there to be an intergalactic performance where people on Earth and people on Mars sing the Martian anthem, because the Martian anthem is not about a planet. It's about our species taking a great leap forward. And I hope this anthem inspires people to dream and to look up to Mars and beyond.
Following in the footsteps of Gustav Holst, Oscar Castellino and his anthem for Mars. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or anything in it, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.